Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Well, it's great to be on the show with you, Randy.
Now, I wanted to ask you, when did you first start playing guitar, and what was it about the guitar that attracted you to it?
Well, I think I first started playing when I was 11 years old, and it's so long ago, it's hard for me to remember exactly how it happened. Maybe I saw a guitar in a catalog, or maybe I saw it, someone playing it, or maybe I heard it on a record or whatever. But I remember my parents either rented or bought me one of those cheap little flat top guitars, and I took some lessons for, I don't know, 6 months, or I don't remember how long it was. And then, I don't know, the lessons really didn't do too much for me, and I stopped. And then at 13, I was in junior high school, and a science teacher offered folk guitar as an elective. So he was teaching us how to play chords, and that I really enjoyed, you know. So that's how I started, you know, getting involved, you know.
Did you come from a musical family?
Actually, not really. Although my mom played piano, she took piano lessons. No one else in my family really played an instrument. Nope.
No way. Now, I want to ask you specifically about your guitars. What brand of guitar do you play, and why do you play that particular brand?
Well, I have two instruments, actually. I have a D'Acquisto, which was built by Jimmy D'Acquisto in 1981 for me. That one is that's sort of like my Stradivarius. I can only take that with me when I, you know, when someone purchases a plane ticket for it, or I don't bring it. And then I have an instrument that I endorse, actually, that's a knockoff of that by James DiCava, and it's called the Mark Elf Custom Classic. And it's a great instrument, and I play it a lot, and I take it on the road with me. So I have actually two instruments that I play. And I've played all different kinds of instruments. I've had Gibsons, and I've had Fenders, and a number of different guitars. But these are the guitars that I use right now.
Is it because it's the sound that you're looking for that you like
it
so much?
Yeah, it's an acoustic archtop guitar. It's got a floating pickup that's attached to the pick guard, and there's really nothing drilled into the wood, into the top, so that it doesn't disrupt the sound of the instrument. You know, it's an acoustic instrument.
Yeah.
But it's electrified through means of a pickup.
Now, one thing that I admire so much about you is the amount of music that you've come out with so far. And I wanted to know, what drives you to keep you recording?
That's a very good question. And really the truth is, I think you could say that it's the same drive that a painter, why does he put a brand new canvas on, you know, up on his easel or whatever you call it, and why does he continue to do that? It's just a drive, and I really, you know, sometimes I'm inspired when I hear something else, and I start writing tunes, and then I want to record them. Mm-hmm. And it's also based in part, although it's not first on the list, that, you know, people that like your music want to hear new stuff by you. And so that kind of drives me too. I want to, you know, put out recordings, and so that'll also keep me in the loop with, you know, with people that are watching my career and venues who may decide to want to have me perform at their festival or concert. They always want to know what's your latest record, you know, and if you tell them, well, I haven't had one in 10 years, you know, it's not so great. But those last two things that I mentioned, that's really not the reason, the main reason why I do it. It's part of the reason. But the real reason, the main reason, is because it's what I do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it would be, like I said, like a painter, you know, not starting a new work, just, you know, being satisfied with something or a number of paintings that he's done, and then just he hangs them on the wall, or other people buy his prints, or he sells them to people, and then And then he just, you know, brushes his hands together and says, okay, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and there are some people, I guess, who have done that, you know, but I as an artist, I can't not do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just something that, and, you know, since I have my own record company, you know, it's a cost to me. It's a tremendous financial investment to do these things.
Right.
So, you know, it's not just something that I take very lightly, and obviously, you know, when I'm investing in myself, I'm putting my own money in the projects, you know, there's a strong need to do it, or, you know, why would anybody want to do that? You know, I mean, it's just a need. The answer is it's an artistic need to have to want to create, mm-hmm. and that's basically the answer.
Well, Mark, we're going to go way back in time here, and I want you to talk about your first professional jazz gig. Now, I know it sounds like it was an exciting moment for you playing with Etta Jones and Gloria Coleman.
Yeah, actually, I don't know if that was actually the very first one, because I was playing with Billy Mitchell during that time, but that's the one that I remember the most. I mean, I had played a couple of gigs with Billy, but I think that was the first one. I may have not played professionally with Billy at that point, but so I think this may have been the first one. And it was at the Club Baron in Harlem on 147th and I think Lenox. I think that's the correct address. And it's not there anymore. But everybody came through there. Dizzy and Sonny Stitt and Gene Ammons. I heard so many great players there in the 70s when I started coming around. And so there I was, Gloria. I remember riding with Gloria uptown in a cab, and Etta Jones was on the gig, and a drummer by the name of Bill English.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the stage was really high up off the floor, and there was a balcony, so the people in the balcony were looking down at you, and the people that were on the floor level were looking up, and the place was always, on the weekends anyway, you know, packed.
Yeah.
And I remember that first gig, I remember there were always two bands. One band would play an hour on and then would take an hour break, and then the next band would come up and play an hour. So I remember that gig, George Benson's quintet was the featured band. We were kind of like the second band.
No.
And I remember George sitting down on the ground floor, staring up at me, watching me, and then he would come on and just tear the place up. I mean, at that time, you know, I was sort of just starting out. So, you know, I had met him several years earlier, actually. I'd met him in 69, so we knew each other, and he's always great, always very supportive of me. So,
that was very
intimidating.
Well, yeah, I can imagine. What did you learn from him that particular night, just having him there in the club with you?
Well, I mean, just, you know, it just inspired you to go home and practice harder. That's basically it. You know, he was always. Friendly, and I remember the first time when I met him up in Boston, I went to go see him play. I was a student up there, and he invited me to his hotel room, and I hung out with him for about an hour and a half.
Wow, that,
and that was really cool. We played together.
Incredible
then, you know.
So are there any secret tapes of that floating around?
Yeah, actually, I have somewhere, I don't know if it's a reel-to-reel I brought with me, to record George and myself playing together, but I don't know where it is. I don't even know if it's good anymore.
You know that?
I have no idea where it is.
That would be an interesting thing to listen to sort of practice to or pick up, you know, ideas or whatever. Going back, maybe listening to George and some of the techniques that he had, or the way
absolutely.
He was, you know. Can you describe what that club looked like inside? Was it big, small, dark?
It was really big, and it had, when you walked in, you saw the bar was oval, sort of It was circular, but it was like a big oval.
Mm.
And then you walked to the left, and the stage was on the left, and the balcony and the floor seats were right there. And it was probably, I'd say, you could see 150 or 200, something like that.
Hmm. Amazing. I want to ask you about your playing now. Who or what has influenced your style?
Oh, so many people have influenced my style. Cal Farlow, Jimmy Rainey, the guitar players, Joe Pass, Jim Hall, Pat Martino, George Benson, and then, of course, saxophone, trumpets, Bird, Dizzy, Kenny Dorham, Clifford Brown, Sonny Stitt, Sonny Stitt and Sonny Rollins, and Dexter, and just all those guys, that whole era of musicians who had such a very distinct sound print of their own playing that when you listened to them on the radio and there wasn't any back announcement, you knew exactly who they were.
Yeah, you could tell within the first two or three notes.
Yeah, Clark Terry, within the first several bars, you knew who it was, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, those are the people that I, you know, put in my highest regard, you know?
If there was only one musician that you could perform or record with, who would that be?
Would that be a living or a dead musician?
Living or dead, just overall.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Charlie Parker.
Yeah. And why would that be?
I would have given, oh, man. Well, to me, I think he was the greatest living jazz musician. I mean, I think he was I don't think there was anybody who had anything that was, I mean, that, to me, that was, he was the cat. And so if I had a chance to play with someone, that would be the person I'd choose.
When I listen to your playing, I can hear a lot of Parker in there, a lot of his influence, and a lot of his concepts as well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. I really loved him. You know, it's unbelievable. I remember Cal Farlow telling me one time that he went to hear Bird play, and he was just, he said, Mark, it was like, how did he describe him? I'm trying to remember. He said, it was like so free, you know, so like in the air, just so, he had a hard time putting it into words, but I got the point.
Right.
And here's one of my heroes talking about one of my heroes. That was really cool.
Yeah, really.
It was cool to hear him. And he actually played me a tape of him and Art Tatum playing together.
Oh, my God. That
and
must
I
have
said,
been amazing.
I said to Tao at that time when he played me that tape, I was hanging out with him down in his house in Seabright, New Jersey. And for some of your listeners that might know who I'm talking about, Cal Farlow is who I'm talking about. I think
Cal, guitarist.
Everybody knows who he is, and some people don't know who he is, but
yeah.
A great, great player, and one of the most influential jazz guitarists of the 1950s. And anyway, so he was telling me, I asked him the question, I said, Cal, what was it like playing with Art Tatum? And he said to me, well, Mark, you didn't really play with Art Tatum. You played along with him.
That's for sure.
I said, he played it for me. It was great, man. It sounded like he was playing with him, though. It was really, really sounded good.
Must have been something else. Now, in a recent interview that I did with pianist Mike Longo, I asked him about his time with Dizzy Gillespie. Now, I want to know how Dizzy altered your musical perspective and what effect he had on your life.
Well, you know, Mike played with him, I think, early in his career, as I remember. I don't know for a fact, but I think, when did he join Dizzy? When he was in his 20s or 30s? I don't remember.
Yeah.
But, I got to play with him sort of later in my career. I got to play with, and it was brief. Mike played with him, I think, for, I don't know, 10 years or more? I don't know.
Quite a while,
but
yeah.
Mike was with him for a long time. I just had a brief stint with him in a European concert setting. It was 11 concerts. And Hank Jones was on the gig, and Curtis Fuller, and Kenny Barron was also a piano player, and who else was on that? Larry Ridley played bass, and Ben Riley played drums, and Billy Mitchell played tenor, and it was a killer band. It was a great series of concerts. And only thing that I could say about that is I remember him saying to me, we were on a bus, and he was standing back of me, and he said, the most important thing in this music is having your own style.
Right.
And that just reverberated through me to this day. And I knew that, but he just sort of reinforced that, you know, reinforced that very important point. And I think why he said that, and I think why it's so important, is because today, you know, with the colleges and institutions turning out musicians one after the other,
yes,
you know, a lot of guys will say get into West Montgomery or get into Train, and you know, and never find their own voice.
Yeah.
They sound so much like that artist that they revere that they forget that the most important thing is to have your own sound and your own style of playing, so that people can identify with what you're about. That's what this music is. It's a very individualistic. You're not supposed to play like anybody else. You're supposed to sound like yourself.
Exactly.
I remember Leroy Williams telling me one time he was overseas with Tommy Flanagan, or was it Barry Harris? He was with Barry Harris. And a Japanese drummer came back to him and introduced himself. He said, my name is so-and-so and so-and-so, and I play like Elvin Jones. And Leroy looked at me and said, well, why don't you play like yourself? He said, no self, Elvin Jones.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, an example of, you know, how, you know, a musician can be so taken with another artist or their hero's work that they forget the whole point of the music.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to be yourself.
Yeah. Now, you recently suffered a serious setback, and I want to know, did the music help you through your ordeal?
Well, let me just put it to you this way, Randy. When I, you know, had those operations 3 years ago and went through all those health issues, my major concern at that time was I was worried, you know, that I was, you know, if I was going to be playing at all. I mean, if I was going to be here.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of life I was going to have after all this was over. Mm. And during that time, I realized how important it was to me to be able to play and just to be able to have the health, the good health, to be able to continue what I was doing. That's why when I finally got over all of that, my record right after that was titled Glad to Be Back.
Yes, I remember
that. That's
one.
How I felt. So I wouldn't say that music helped me through that, because when you're going through all that, you're really not thinking too much about music. You're just thinking about trying to get better, trying to live.
Yes.
And trying to get your health back so that you can play.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you realize that when you finally pick up your guitar or your instrument, whatever it is, the case may be, in my case, my guitar, how grateful you are to be able to just create something, be here to create it. That's really what my thoughts were on that during that time.
Yeah. Of all the albums that you've made, do you have a favorite?
No, not really. There's some. Each one has its own personality, its own vibe. I would say I don't listen to them anymore, so I don't remember. But I would say Dream Steppin' I liked, and I liked New York Cats. A lot of people like that record because it's got a lot of familiar tunes on it, and also Glad to Be Back. And my recent one, I guess, Liftoff. But I suppose, you know, some of the other ones like Trichinometry with Nicholas Payton and Christian McBride, my wife tells me she absolutely loves that when she listens to it in her car. So, you know, different tracks on different albums. I think one day I'll maybe do a disc, maybe the best of Mark Elf, just to try to put all the very best tracks on one record, you know?
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, with all the concerts that you give and all the teaching, do you ever spend any time practicing?
Oh, I have to practice, absolutely.
Is there a specific method that you use?
No. I might be working on a tune or a particular concept, like Liftoff. I was working on getting ready to record that album. I was working on those John Coltrane changes of Countdown that Liftoff, my melody based on his chord progression, on his tune. That took hundreds and hundreds of hours to work on that because it's so difficult to play on.
Mm-hmm.
And I created my own melody and on that. And so when I sit down and practice, usually it's very specific about a particular, maybe a set of chord changes I'm working on, or maybe a particular idea that I'm working out through the keys, or, you know, it might be some voicings that I'm trying to come up with, or trying to voice work on a chord melody to a particular tune. So that I'm working on at that moment. So it's not like rigid. Well, I play all of my scales and then I play all of my arpeggios. No, I don't do that anymore. You know, there was a time when I did that, but you know, not anymore.
Do you remember the first jazz concert that you ever attended?
Yes, I do. It was in fact, I was with my mom. I was probably 17 years old, something like that. And it was an outdoor concert. It was Roland Kirk.
Mm.
Rahsaan Roland Kirk, and I really liked his music and I loved his whole thing. And I remember it was threatening to rain, and he said, "I'm going to blow the clouds away."
Wow.
And he did. It never rained.
Well, Mark, I have to tell you something. When I was about 13 years old, the first concert I ever saw was Dizzy Gillespie and his big band, along with Gene Krupa and his big band. And when Dizzy Gillespie came out on stage, he said he had a special guest that he wanted to bring out that was playing at the Esquire Show Bar in Montreal. And Rahsaan Roland Kirk came out. This was back in 1971. And he just blew me away. Amazing musician.
Yeah. Yeah, that was some concert you went to.
It was very special, you know. I never saw anybody play with three saxes at the same time.
Yeah.
And make some really good music along, you know.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any projects in the works at the moment?
No, as a matter of fact, nothing right now. It's unusual, but it's probably because I'm still involved with my latest recording, Liftoff.
Hmm.
And you know, as soon as everything quiets down from that, and it kind of stops, you know, this right now it's number 3 on National Jazz Radio in the United States here, and I'm doing interviews like this, and I'm busy with involved in the promotion, and I'm, you know, playing gigs and playing those tunes that are on that record. And usually when I'm doing that, and sometimes I am working on other things, but I'm still actually involved with that recording right now. That's like my new painting, so to speak, you know.
Yeah.
And so probably when all of that quiets down, then I can just kind of say, okay, now next, and then I'll start writing, or something will inspire me to write a tune and I'll be off working on the next album, you know.
How long has your band been performing?
Well, I don't have any set band. In order to have a set band, you have to be playing on a regular basis, touring on a regular basis. And since I don't tour on a regular basis, to keep the same band together is impossible. I mean, there are a handful of guys who have that luxury. I think the Yellow Jackets and a couple of those kind of groups, maybe even Christian McBride's band and a couple of the Herbie's group maybe. But I don't know a whole lot that can keep the same, because musicians, sidemen, have to keep working. And so, you know, if they get another gig, they have to take it. And then when you go to call them, they're already working with someone else. So that's one of the things Duke Ellington used to do. He used all of his publishing money to keep his orchestra together. You know,
right.
He put them on retainers so that, you know, I mean, they could work with other bands, but when he called them, they had to give him the first, you know, the first action. In other words, they had to go with him. If he said, we got a gig on July 21st, you know, even if they had something else going July 21st, they had to cancel that and go with Duke because they were on retainer. So it's I don't really have a steady man, but I always get great musicians to work with me, and I have a slew of guys that I can call that are top-shelf players. And I have a book, you know, what I mean by a book is, you know, the music that I play and perform, and
right.
These guys can perform it with no problem. I just give them the book, and I tell them what tunes we're doing, and we play.
You know, I have to tell you, Mark, I've always liked listening to your original compositions. I really find them not only uplifting, but the arrangements are snappy. And what I wanted to know is, where do you draw your inspiration and ideas from when it comes to composing?
You know, it's a very funny thing. Sometimes I'll hear something on the radio and it'll inspire me to think of something or write something. Sometimes I'd be in the shower and all of a sudden I just start singing an idea and then I just start writing it down and it just comes, you know?
Mm.
I mean, other times, funny, an instrument, my new baritone guitar inspired me to write Chewy's Challenge and a couple of other tunes. It can come from anywhere, and I really can't tell you how it happens because it just happens, and you just start thinking of something or whistling something or getting an idea from something you might have heard that inspires you to go somewhere else with that idea, and it's hard to really answer that question because there really is no one answer, you know?
Yeah. When you're performing, oftentimes you'll be playing or something like that, and then does it ever happen to you where you think to yourself, my God, where did that come from?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know?
Yeah, actually, usually it doesn't happen when I'm performing, but if somebody has recorded it or if I hear it back,
yeah.
And I say, man, where did that, I you know, I didn't even realize I did that.
Yeah,
yeah, that and that's always good because that means that you're creating, you're not just spitting out stuff you know and leaning on, you know, your repertoire of ideas and of, you know, of phrases that you know over the years, and you're creating new things all the time. You want that to happen. That's something that's very, very important for a jazz artist to want to be able to keep his or her ideas fresh and new.
You're in the moment.
Right.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Eternal Triangle. Now, for me, this is one recording where your playing is showcased and supported by a superb group of musicians working with you. Having seasoned veterans can only raise the bar in such a session. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, yeah, you're right. When I did that session, that was Hank Jones, Ben Riley, Ray Drummond, and Jimmy Heath. And, you know, every one of those people... and especially Hank, Jimmy, and Ben Riley, you know, were heroes to me, and played with, you know, Monk and Train and all these, everybody, you know, and when I think of who Hank Jones played with, Charlie Parker, just every major influence, you know, besides his own prowess, you know,
right.
So. You know, you're on your very best, you're reaching for the best performance that you can come up with. So, yeah, it definitely causes you. I mean, I spent a long time shedding that record before I went into the studio. I don't recall, there was no rehearsal. I think I went in cold.
Wow.
I think I went over to Jimmy's house to go over a couple of tunes with him, but that was it. A lot of my records are like that. There's no rehearsal.
So,
because a lot of these musicians I can't get a hold of. Sometimes they'll be on the road the day before and say, look, man, I'm getting back into town. that the night before, but if you want me to make the date, I'll make it. And I say, sure. And sometimes I'll send them the music, and if they're on the road, they can't see the music or whatever, then, you know, we just go to the studio and do it.
So when we listen to a Mark Elf recording, for the most part, we're listening to first takes.
You're listening to the first time I play with a lot of those people, yeah.
So that's why it's so fresh.
Yeah, maybe so.
Yeah.
I know that some of my favorite recordings are like that, but, you know, when you think about, I mean, if I had the luxury of having a steady band like Art Blakey did, you know, and
right.
being on the road, and then, you know, one day you're playing in the club, the next day you're playing in the studio, you get that group magic happening, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I hope one day I get an opportunity to do that. A lot of these records I do are, you know, they're just one shot, and that's it. Like the latest record, there was no rehearsal on that. Glad to Be Back, there was no rehearsal on that. There's a number of records where I had no rehearsal.
Do you find it difficult getting proper airplay?
No. My records have been played, had tremendous airplay. There's been, the last eight of them have gone to number one.
No.
On national jazz radio here in the United States. They get huge airplay. This latest one is sitting at number three right now.
What about overseas, like in Europe and Japan? Are you getting airplay over there as well?
I had sent some records over there. I don't know if they were ever played over there, but my music is available all over the internet. You know, it's
right.
It's available on iTunes and all the major download sites.
Right.
There's like 120 tracks up there. So, you know, and since a lot of with the internet happening, since I get played so strongly here, a lot of jazz fans tune in through the internet to radio stations in the United States. And so a lot of people around the world will hear my music because of that.
So speaking of the internet, how has that changed your life? How has that altered things for you?
Oh, well, I mean, now I don't have to worry about having a distribution deal with someone in Germany or someone in France or someone in Romania or wherever it might be, or Japan or whatever, because since my recordings are now digitally distributed, meaning iTunes,
right.
MSN, you know, Music Match, whatever, wherever it might be, you know, in whatever country has you know, these services and their own services. That's just a few that I mentioned. There are hundreds of these type of legal download sites all over the world,
mm-hmm.
and most of my music, or all of my music, is on most of these sites. So now the ability for someone who happens to tune into a radio station or hear about me or read about me or find out about me through someone else can go to their computer, type in my name in a power search, and bring up 120 tracks. And they can hear a 20-second clip of those tracks and decide whether they want to download one track or the whole album or all of it. So,
that's amazing, eh?
Yeah, so now, you know, with the age of digital distribution, I no longer have to worry or beg somebody overseas to buy my records from me, or to at least distribute my records from me, you know, distribute the records and then get them overseas. And then I got to worry about how am I going to get paid, and this guy takes off with my records and never pays me. I mean, there's always those things that happen. And with this digital distribution, that's no longer a worry. So it's really, and it's helped thousands, hundreds of thousands, I'm sure, independent musicians in all formats of music. You know, so no longer do the major labels or major indie
things.
Labels or big labels, you know, have the upper hand.
Right. Is there any musical setting or project that you would love to be involved in that you haven't experienced yet?
Yeah. Actually, I'd love to do an album with strings, and I'd like to play, you know, just ballads, just for music for lovers, or, you know, just something beautiful. Just, in fact, people have asked me when I've played ballads at my concerts, they've come out and they've, you know, really loved your ballad playing. Do you have a record with just that?
So that's along the lines of Clifford Brown when he made that beautiful album with strings.
Oh yeah. Oh, that was absolutely gorgeous.
You know.
Yeah, I would love to do a project like that, you know, but it's very, very expensive. You need, you know, to hire string sections and, you know,
yeah.
So, you know, it's in the future, and I'm not saying I won't do it, but it's something that's definitely there that I want to do, you know.
Are you involved in any teaching or mentoring at the moment?
Well, I do clinics all over the country and the world. I do different colleges. I do clinics, and students come to my home to learn. They come to my home studio to take lessons with me, and so, yes, I do that.
I'm going to list for you five names, and I want you to discuss the first thing that comes to mind. Now, it's funny because my list here off the top is someone that we've already discussed, but I want you to discuss him further. Tel Farlow.
Brilliant.
And what about Jackie McLean?
Great sound.
Someone who I thought you were influenced by, but you never mentioned during the interview, was Barney Kessel.
Huh? I like Barney's playing, but I never actually listened to Barney that much.
He was an outstanding performer, though. He was really special.
Yeah, he was great. Sure.
What about Dave Brubeck?
Take Five.
Yeah. And, of course, Wes Montgomery.
One of the greatest jazz guitar players that ever lived.
Yeah, I'll vouch for that. Now, there's an important musician this year who's celebrating his 80th birthday, and I'd like to know your thoughts on Tony Bennett.
Oh, man. He's an icon. He's fabulous. Not only is he a beautiful vocalist and gives jazz musicians lots of space to play, he loves jazz musicians. This guy, you can tell, you know, when he's on in a concert, he tells the audience who's played the solo, and he gives the guys space to solo and play. And as a musician, you love that because you know that, you know, he cares about the musicians, you know. So that's the kind of, well, he's a beautiful person. From what everyone tells me, I've never met him, but that he's a great soul. And you get that feeling from him in his music, in his voice, and you get that feeling from him when you hear him talk in interviews and, you know, in any verbal things that he's involved with. You get that feeling of inner beauty, you know?
Yeah, it's this positive, uplifting feeling that you get immediately when you hear him.
Yeah.
You know, it's very special.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about Djenbe. Why and how was that label created? And was it to give you more freedom as an artist?
Well, at first, I had one recording I had done down in Santiago, Chile. And when the record company down there, Alerce, came to me and said, well, it's great music, Mark. We appreciate what you did. Well, what do we do with it?
Yeah.
I knew I was in trouble. And I had had tried to get some record deals with some other companies and, you know, ran around trying to sell masters and, you know, trying to hook up with different companies. And every company had its own agenda, and at the time, no one seemed to be interested. So I said, well, why should I give my music to them, especially if they're not going to be receptive to me? Let me start my own record company and put my own records out, and let's see how the public and how jazz radio and the press feel about my music. And if they reject me like these companies have, then, you know, maybe I'll just be a milkman.
Well, you know, it's funny because
No, but what I'm trying to say is that, you know, just because a record company decides they don't want to record you or they're not interested in you, it doesn't mean that what you're doing isn't valid or isn't good.
That's right.
So what I did was I started Djenbe, and Djenbe is basically my daughter's name is Jenny, and I live by the bay. So that's how I got the name, okay? Gen Bay Records was a record company. So I sent the records out to radio. I sent the records out to I sent the records out to press, and I started getting incredible responses from radio. The first record went to number 7 on National Jazz Radio, and the second one went to number 4 on jazz radio, and then after that, 8 consecutive number 1 records on National Jazz Radio. And it's been an overwhelming response, to my music. And as an artist, it's just so, I don't know how to say it, I just feel so happy about it and thrilled that so many people in radio and press, you know, came to me and said in their actions by playing and giving positive reviews that, yeah, we really think you're a terrific artist and we really like your music. And it was a great feeling to realize that, you know, I mean, you see, the truth is, Randy, I mean, before I did all of that, I had played with Dizzy. I worked with Billy Mitchell. I played with Junior Cook and Bill Hardman, with Jimmy McGriff and Groove Holmes and all these great players, you know, and they hired me and they liked my playing. But yet the record companies wouldn't pay any attention to me, you know?
Money's the bottom line.
So, and maybe, and looking back at it, maybe I didn't try hard enough. But I felt to myself at that time, I said, you know, if I've got to go and pester these people and beg these people to give me a record deal, you know, this is not the way it should be. I shouldn't have to go through this, although a lot of musicians do. They'll sign their publishing away. They'll do anything to have a record company record them. And, you know, I wasn't willing to do that, and I didn't want to do that. And I'm glad that I didn't do it. Now musicians are calling me all the time asking me, what do I recommend that they do? And I help a lot of musicians actually through the years realize that they don't have to have, especially now with the digital distribution thing going on, that they don't have to have a record company take care of business for them. If musicians put in 25% of the time taking care of business as they did practicing, you know, they could get their music out there. And so I try to help a lot of guys and women, get their stuff out there without having to give their publishing away. And I tell them, you know, this way you can own your own masters, you can own your own, you have control over your product. The stuff's not going to go out of print unless you decide it goes out of print.
Do you have any plans to maybe sign more artists to your label?
No. And the reason why at this point, no, because the reality is that jazz recordings don't sell very well, and the reality is that just trying to break even on my own projects is a difficult task. And it's really mainly to catalog my work, to give my fans the music that they're asking me for, you know, I mean, that they know when I put out a record, you know, many of the same people buy my record and new people discover my music and buy the record. So it's been building rapidly over the last 10 or 11 years, and I've been building a pretty good fan base, and you know, I'm doing it from, you know, groundwork, but to finance other people's projects, when people come to me and say, hey, you know, I got a record, we couldn't put it out on your label, I tell them, put it out on your own label. Do it yourself.
Right.
You don't have to give your music to me. I don't want to take your music away from you. If you give it to me, it doesn't belong to you anymore. It belongs to me.
DIY, right?
Yeah.
Do it yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Mark, you've been on the road a lot, touring with your band and with other musicians. Now, along the way, you must have had some funny musical stories. Care to share maybe one or two with us?
Oh, gee. I wish I could think of one or two right off the top of my head. Let me see. Oh, I remember one time going to a gig with Billy Mitchell. This is very early on. I guess I was maybe 19 years old or 20 years old. He hired me for a gig. I was thrilled to be there. And it was a school concert. It was like at a high school. And I don't know whether it was early in the morning or whatever it was, but we got to the school, and the school was locked. We couldn't get in. So there was a window open, and they hoisted me up and pushed me through the window so I could open the doors for them. That was... And then I remember, what?
You didn't get in any trouble over that? Or?
No. It's just that the custodians had the doors locked, and I don't know if there was anybody in the building or not. Maybe the custodians were in the building, but they didn't know we were standing outside, and it was freezing out there. I think it was the winter time, you know? Oh. So they were trying to get in. I don't remember whether it was winter, but I think it was. And we had to get up and get set up and get the equipment in the school. So that was one thing that I remember. But there's always this. There's so many stories. I remember being on the road with Jack McDuff and the car and the organ, the trailer with the organ, and it broke down in the middle of Route 9. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, driving to Detroit. I mean, it was a mess. And, well, so many things I can't. You have to give me notice on that so I can think about it.
I want to go back to 1993 when you went to Chile to make the Mark Elf Trio album. Now, how was that experience? How did that experience happen for you? How did that all come about?
I went down there in 91 with Arnie Lyons, alto saxophone player.
He's
recently passed away. And the musicians down there, we did some concerts, and they apparently, unbeknownst to me, had recorded them on a video, on a cassette, you know. And about a year later, I get a call, and the drummer, Alejandro Espinosa, called me up, and he said, "Hey, man, we'd love you to come down and do some concerts with us down here." So I said, "Man, I'd love to." I booked a gig, and I was going to go down there for a week, and it was like a cabana on the beach in the north of Chile, and it was like a festival for 3 days and outdoor concerts, and it was exciting. You know, they liked my playing, and they wanted me to come back, so they called me directly. About 2 weeks before I went there, I get a call from him again, and he says, "Hey, Mark, there's a company down here who wants to record you. Would you be interested in doing an album for them?" And I said, "How do they know about me?" He said, "Well, we took the tapes when you were down here with Arnie, and we let them listen to it. And they said, we want him."
Wow.
So that was actually, when I was telling you about running around in New York trying to find a record deal, here was a company who heard me down in Santiago, Chile, and through the musicians, and decided they wanted to. That was my first record company to approach me, you know, to ask me to record for their label. So that's how that happened.
I want to ask you, earlier on in the interview, I was asking you about your various guitars, and one of them that I'm really curious about is the baritone guitar. Now, what exactly is that?
Well, it's a... Basically, it's a bass guitar, but it has the same, but it has 6 strings on it, and it has the same tuning as a regular guitar, but the strings, and it also has the same scale. It's a 25.5-inch scale, so, and it's got very thick strings on it because of the, you know, the bass strings on it, so that it can be an octave below the guitar, which is where it is, I couldn't find a guitar like that. All the bass guitars were either 5, and the ones that I did find that were 6 strings, the scale was really long, and it was a huge. They were huge instruments, and I mean, I could have played it, and I could have worked on it, practiced it. And I said, you know what? Why? I had known about a baritone guitar because a company named Dan Electro used to make them, and when when I went to look for one, they were no longer making them. I mean, recently when I decided I wanted to play one. So I ordered a guitar body and neck and some bass strings and gave it to Jim DeCava, the guy who built me one of my guitars, and said, look, man, make me a baritone guitar.
Yeah.
He said, okay, send the parts over. So I sent the parts over, and he made it for me, and that's how it happened.
I want to ask you about your album, Liftoff. Now, the first time that I heard the tune Liftoff, I was, like, totally blown away. And I have to ask you, did you have any fingers left after you played that particular tune?
Well, man, it's not so much the fingers, but the mental strain of playing that tune. You know, Jimmy Heath told me that John Coltrane practiced those chord changes for the better part of 2 years before he recorded it. And, you know, it's not so much, yeah, it is a physical challenge to play bright tempos, but it's more with that tune, the key center's changing every two beats that make it so difficult. So it's just a real challenge, and that's why I wanted to do it. Just something that was over the top, you know.
Yeah.
And I wanted to try to. So it's sort of, let's put it to you this way, it's kind of like a mountain climber looking at Everest and wanting to get to the top of the mountain.
Yeah, very good
and
description.
Still come down alive.
Yeah.
Or not caring if he came down alive, even to that point, you know. I mean, everybody wants to live after an experience like that, but some people just, you know, they're driven to do things come what may, you know.
Yeah. Now, you have the same lineup you had on your Glad to Be Back release. Now, one gets the feeling that there's a lot of cohesiveness and a lot of fun going on there with the group. Do you care to comment on that?
Well, these guys are consummate professionals. You know, David Hazeltine, Peter Washington, and Louis Nash. Well, first of all, Peter and Louis are on so many records. There's probably hundreds and hundreds of them at this point. I don't know how many record dates they've done.
They're the Ron Carter of the drums.
Huh?
They're the Ron Carter of the drums, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, and he can assimilate and get with whatever's happening. He's just absolutely able to do whatever it takes. And he's a very good reader, and so is Peter. So, you know, there's never worry about them, you know, having a problem reading the music or getting... I mean, it's just, you know, that's why I can do an album without a rehearsal, because of that higher echelon of musicianship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. And those guys, you know, they work as sidemen constantly because of that. So, you know, that's why I can go in and do an album cold and not worry about it.
Well, on that note, Mark, I want to thank you for dropping by today. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Randy. It was a lot of fun.